Well, thank you so much. And let me wish everyone a, I guess it's good afternoon, technically, wherever you are. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Today, we're fortunate enough to have an event with one of our senior fellows, who I'll introduce in a second. And it's one of my favorite events because it's associated with the launch of his book. The fellow is Yanjiang Wang. He is a senior fellow in global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also a professor at Seton Hall. He is one of the real authorities in this country, or any country for that matter, on China, on health policy in China, and on global health governance. And he's been an active, prolific part of the team at the Council on Foreign Relations, writing, assessing, prescribing about the current the COVID-19 crisis and what ought to be done. But today we are going to talk about, see if I get this up. This, I hope that's backwards or not. If it is, I can't help you. Toxic Politics, a great title. The subtitle of Yanjiang's book is China's Environmental Health Crisis and Its Challenge to the Chinese State. So as you can tell, it basically looks at things environmental. It looks at things health, it looks at things economic, and it looks at things political, and it succeeds at drawing the connections between and among these books, which is why I think this is such a valuable book. So often we have in this academic world of ours siloed studies. And as I have been known to point out, universities have departments, but the world doesn't. And this is a book that I think does us all the favor of connecting things that in reality are connected. So congratulations, Yang Zhang, and thanks for being with us today. What we're going to do is the two of us are going to have a conversation for some time, and then I will turn it over to you, our members and others, to ask the questions. And we will finish at 59 minutes and 59 seconds after the hour, because we have the principle of being punctual. And while we do not live up always to all of our principles, we try to live up to that one as it's more in our control. So again, welcome, sir, and congratulations. And as I said, I'm not just flattering you. I think it's a truly important book.
Well, thank you,
And you're
Richard.
muted. Good. Now you're
Well, thank
talking.
you,
Now I can
Richard,
hear you.
for that very generous introduction. Actually, I benefited a lot from your feedback in the writing of this book. And in fact, when I was reading this title, actually, the title, I think also in part, you helped me finalize that title. And I also like to thank everyone today who's participating in today's book talk. And in fact, many of you, in one way or the other, help the book writing process. So with that, a big thank you.
Well, thanks. Let's walk through it. Let's walk the listeners and viewers through this. Let's start out with things environmental. What is the state of China's environmental policy situation, and how and why did it get as severe as it's gotten? Why don't you say a little bit about how it evolved and why it evolved the way it did?
Well, the situation today actually is, I would say, mixed. On the one hand, you've seen some very encouraging progress being made. Pollution control, if you look at the PM2.5, that is the most harmful type of air pollution, that it's essentially the fine particles, in the air smaller than 2.5 micrometers in diameter. If you look at the concentration of PM2.5, again, the most harmful type of air pollution, beginning 2013, and through 2018, we have seen actually a significant reduction of the pollution level thanks to a government campaign of sort of a blue sky campaign that this managed to reduce the PM2.5 concentration level by 46%. But in the meantime, if you look at the recent data, right, it seems not so encouraging. Right? We have the data from the non-governmental organization that suggested that the pollution, especially in the wake of the COVID in China, has actually returned or exceeded the level 1 year before. That was in 2019. And if you look at the steel production, you know, coal production consumption level, this is all important source of pollution in China. They have also, you know, they peaked in like 2013, 2014. Then we have actually seen, you know, the increase since 2017. And that continued through today.
Why don't you explain to us, because I'm not an expert, and I would hazard that maybe most others aren't either. How does China go about making the trade-offs between things like economic growth and pollution? How is decision-making carried out? And if there's been changes, have there been times when one or the other dominated the consideration?
Well, this dilemma between the economic growth and the environmental protection, I think, has become an issue, you know, since the Mao era, right? When Chairman Mao's campaign against nature have caused, you know, a lot of the devastating impact on the economy, on the society, on the nature. But the problem has not getting really worse until the post-Mao era, when you know you have this rapid industrialization and modernization, and that interacts with this government reliance on the performance-based legitimacy. You know, that is, the government basically justify its rule on the ability to deliver economic growth, you know, and ability to fulfillment concrete goals, you know, so that this dilemma becomes exacerbated in the post-Mao era. And that is why we have seen, you know, this suddenly, like in 2013, seeing like this smog, you know, pollution become headlines in the Chinese media. You know, after that, you know, then you have seen the Chinese government try to tackle pollution. You know, so there's a slight shift in the government agenda, especially under President Xi Jinping, you know, with his so-called two mountains thesis, you know, basically say, well, golden mountain, silver mountain, well, that's no better than, you know, the green mountain. So he started to show his commitment on pollution control. That actually led to, you know, this reduction of air pollution and to a lesser extent water pollution in China. But now, you know, we have seen the swing again return, right? Because, right, especially actually since 2018, this strong urge, right, to promote, stimulate economic growth. Then after the COVID, you know, they want to just make up the loss incurred by the outbreak. And so that is why you have seen that the Premier Li Keqiang talk about the so-called store economy, essentially encouraging people, you know, to set up this curbside, you know, these shops, you know, which is considered a potential contributor to the environmental pollution. And so that again, you know, so this dilemma between pollution and economic growth. So I would say China is still lurking between, you know, these two trends, environmental protection, then environmental degradation.
Let's look at pre-COVID Chinese health. So you have a lot of your, you know, your book was essentially written, or more than was written, before COVID. And as I understood it, it's been a few months since I read it now, but there was a Essentially, you were making the case that the degradation of the environment in the name of economic growth and so forth had exacted a serious price in public health. Why don't you say something about that?
Well, the problem here is that the environmental degradation, not just having this harmful impact on people's health. You know, we know that as early as 2015, 1.8 million Chinese people died of pollution. You know, that make China the country that is most adversely affected by pollution in terms of impact on health. But the pollution's impact is not just confined to human health. You know, it also has its impact to failed economy, in the society, and even in the polity, I mean, political legitimacy. Right? There was a study by World Bank that suggested that China lost 10% of its GDP to pollution. You know, that was actually based on the impact on the caused by the premature death. But if I in the book included the impact also on the non-fatal illness, actually the percentage become even larger. It's as high as like 18% of China's GDP. You know, so it's a big impact on China's economy.
So I understand that the impact on health of environmental degradation, you think you basically put your calculation showed that it was causing nearly, I think it was 2 million deaths a year, plus a lot of sickness, and basically subtracting somewhere from a tenth to a fifth of China's economy?
Yeah. So different models being used to estimate the impact on the economy. And we use this model sort of that was derived from Tom Schelling's, you know, that measures this sort of value statistical life, well, VSL, you know, basically just not talking about this direct impact on GDP, but also how, you know, people value those intangible things, you know, like health, you know, like, and that in fact, people value health also changes longitudinally, because you could say 20 years ago, you know, people only value their life, you know, like $280,000, but now they value the statistical life yield as high as $1 million. You know, so that keeps changing. And even the Chinese leaders recognized in that this one of the contradictions for the Chinese development is that, you know, this people's expectations now, you know, changed.
Just so I understand, as is already painfully obvious, I am not an expert. So was it that the Chinese leadership for a long time didn't understand the connection between what they were doing to the environment and public health? Or was it that they understood it, but essentially it wasn't a priority for them?
Well, that is true. In fact, just to look at PM 2.5, right? It was until 2010, you know, that was not even included in the Chinese measurement of air quality, right? Might recall that in 2008, right, in the Beijing Olympic Games, when the U.S., you know, the athletes arrived in Beijing wearing the mask, you know, that was considered like an insult to the Chinese people, because they believe the Chinese, you know, that the people still have a poor understanding of what PM 2.5 is, how dangerous the air was, you know. So the U.S. athletics, the sports team had to apologize for wearing the mask, you know. So that just shows, you know, how poor the Chinese leaders and policymakers understood the harmful effects of pollution. But again, well, with this authoritarian regime, you know, that still has not prevented them from getting exposed to these new concepts, you know, including PM 2.5, sustainable development. According to the Chinese official media, President Xi Jinping, when he was the party secretary in Zhejiang province, he learned about these new terms like sustainable development, the human development, you know. So that is actually why he started to propose that concept called Two Mountain Thesis when he was in Zhejiang. So in 2012, when he became formally the top Chinese leader, you know, he started to basically incorporate this concept in the decision-making process.
And there's all those stories about how the, I think it was the U.S. Embassy would put out the daily measure of air pollution. Essentially, was the Chinese leadership in some ways caught unprepared for the, how would I call it, the political traction of environmental issues?
Well, when the U.S. Mission in Beijing, you know, installed that the rooftop device to measure the PM2.5 level, you know, it was the initial purpose was just to inform, you know, the embassy staff and also the expatriates in Beijing about the pollution level in Beijing. But they, many of the, when they started to broadcast using Twitter accounts, you know, many Chinese people also learned about the Twitter. They learned about how serious the problem was, which is placed in sharp contrast to the official, right, the level of the air quality. You know, so they started to ask, you know, the government to include the PM2.5 in the monitoring of the air quality. But the Chinese government, you thought that was interference of the Chinese internal affairs. They even lodged privately complaints to the embassy officials, you know, say this could cause trouble, you know, to us, you know, including the social political stability. But the embassy officials didn't give a budge, you know, and eventually it helped China to democratize its air pollution data, you know. So that is, I think, is a very good example of how, you know, the U.S.-China engagement actually could produce positive results.
Interesting. I want to talk about COVID in two phases, if I can. I can't resist the temptation to raise it with you. One is the early phases. So roughly December of last year, January this year, we just published, as you know, we being the Council on Foreign Relations, we sponsored a task force that just published a study of the pandemic, both the current one and preparing for the next one. And it was quite critical of China's behavior early on. Was there anything about that behavior which surprised you? I mean, you can describe it yourself, but essentially it was a little bit of shoot the messenger when bad news was happening. Rather than reacting to the bad news, they were reacting to those who were putting out the bad news, not cooperating fully with the WHO, not cooperating with the US and other governments. Was there anything about that was out of character, or is this exactly what you would have expected and predicted?
Well, if we compare the initial handling of the COVID outbreak with the 2002-2000 SARS outbreak, you know, that we did see this strong parallel, right, between the two in terms of the denial, lack of transparency, you know, and inaction, right? But we have indeed seen some progress, other fronts, for example, the sharing of the scientific data, including genome sequencing of the virus, right? The Chinese scientists were able to sequence the virus in a very short period of time, you know, that and when they shared with the international scientific community, including the WHO, I was in around January 10th, you know, that was, you know, compared to SARS, I think it was, they've made a very good progress in the sharing of the information. The problem is that this pattern, right, of lack of response, you know, that that cover up continue to be seen even in the COVID outbreak. We know that the first, the onset of the COVID symptoms occurred as early as December 1st, maybe even early. But the government has not taken any decisive action until late January. If you also look at the local government response, you know, they were already like a healthcare official, workers being infected in early January, and the local government officials knew that, but they keep that information right from the away from the public, and even keep it from Beijing until I believe January 16th, January 17th, you know, so, you know, that delayed the Beijing's sharing of the information with the WHO, you know, so, you know, like in January 14th, the WHO is still saying, well, this is, we are not sure this is a human-to-human transmitted virus, even though at that time, the local, this has already become an open secret at the local level in the frontline hospital.
And just out of curiosity, why would they have done that? Was it just to, I guess I don't understand. Wouldn't it have been in the government's interest to say this is very dangerous, people should act accordingly? Why was there the delayed willingness to basically admit or acknowledge that this was a virus that could have human-to-human transmission?
Well, I think this is here where the institutional reasons play a more prominent role here is that, you know, we know that in China, that the government officials, local government officials, they are only accountable to their immediate superiors. You know, so they want to look good, right, in the eyes of their superiors as underlings. You know, they don't want to look bad by reporting bad news. You know, so if you report something, you know, that turn out to be like a false alarm, you know, that really make you look bad, and it could may also have implications for social political stability, right? There's local, there's the feel, you know, and chaos, you know, might be an immediate threat to social political stability, which is sort of like a buzzword, right, in China's official term. You know, so they got to be very careful, you know, not to allow, you know, this kind of transparency, information sharing, communication to cause trouble to the local social political stability. I think that is one of the main reasons, but of course you also have other reasons, but like the two meetings in Wuhan, you know, then in the Hubei province, you know, the two most important political meetings at the local level, you know, during that period, you know, they want to make sure everything looked good, right? That nothing bad happened, you know, so that also explained those cover up of the actual infection level in the localities.
Now, right now, after that, shall we say, rather poor start, the first month to 2 months. One now looks at China, economic growth has resumed at a pretty robust rate. The number of infections seems way down. Number of deaths seems quite modest compared to other societies. One, can we trust the statistics right now, do you think? And two, is basically the general perception that China has put the worst behind it. And right now it seems to be economically reviving, that it seems to have the health challenge pretty much, not entirely, but pretty much under control. Can we base, is that basically accurate?
Well, if we look at the data, especially the current data, you know, since we don't have the actual information on the number of symptomatic carriers, right? So it's very hard to say, well, how many people in China are infected, but there is no denying that China is considered one of the safest places for in terms of the threat of COVID. Recently were in Kashgar, right? They found like more than 130 asymptomatic carriers. Well, there's people who are tested positive, you know, but we don't know to what extent, you know, they pose a significant threat to people's health because, you know, most of those cases seems to be fine. Not that contagious. They usually do not cause severe symptoms, you know, leading to hospitalization. We don't know what the exact level of infection in the country, but it seems that the situation is pretty much under control. That said, you know, that even with all those government measures, even with, you know, all this the progress and success, you know, we don't know whether that means, you know, we're going to see the same thing happen, you know, again, well, within 14 years ago, actually 17 years ago, made the prediction, right? If we don't tackle the root cause of the problem, I'm talking about political institutional cause of the problem, we're going to the same tragedy happening again. Now, here you go, the COVID. And now if you look at the government official narrative on the outbreak, right, that it's all what talk about, you know, learning the lessons, but this part, the political institutional aspect of the lesson learning has not been touched upon, in my opinion.
I was going to circle to that. Let me ask you one or two questions more before we get to that, and then I'll open it up to our members. There's recently been all sorts of announcements about China's continued construction of coal plants. Obviously, that will have environmental consequences. Help me understand why. Is it, again, that economic considerations triumph over all else, and they're basically saying, we realize this will have some health and other consequences, but that's a price we have to pay, more important. We keep employment up, productivity up. What's going on here?
Well, there in 2020, we found that they issued more permits to those coal power fired power plants than in 2018 and 2019 respectively. But that problem could be traced to even early. There's this strong urge for economic development. And even though the government has shown commitment in pollution control, it has delegated that the authority to approve those fired power plants to the local level. You know, so the local level had the strong incentive to stimulate economic growth. So we have seen actually since 2017, 2018, they started to promote those coal-fired power plants, even though it is an important source of the pollution in China, given that even today, you know, 58% of the Chinese energy, the consumption come from coal.
So that suggests again that whatever the environmental or public health costs are, China's willing to pay them. And if it were otherwise, Xi Jinping doesn't always have, let's put this gently, he doesn't always give local authorities that degree of discretion. So this suggests to me he's consciously giving them that discretion because he doesn't want to make potentially some politically awkward trade-offs.
Well, that's exactly the issue, right? That the authoritarian system, even though right under President Xi, right, this political power has been so centralized, right? That led to what we call this bandwagon polity. You know, it seems that everybody is gung-hoing about his favorite policy agenda. But in the meantime, at the implementation level, you know, still the local governments played a primary role, you know, in deciding, you know, what to implement and how to implement. You know, this is what called the selective implementation or implementation bias. That is an inherent feature of the Chinese polity.
So let me ask then a big general political question, and then I'll stop, which is so much of the American debate right now about China is about the challenge or threat posed by China, the technology challenge in lots of areas, military challenge, Belt and Road, ideological challenge, you name it. Yet one of the possible conclusions a reader might draw from your book is that we are exaggerating China's strength, or at a minimum, underestimating China's weaknesses, some of its brittleness. Is that fair? And why don't you say something about that? Because I think this might be, it's interesting given the context of our conversation in the United States about China.
Yeah, that is true, especially after the COVID outbreak. You know, we even though we the China and the United States might disagree to what extent China poses a threat to the United States, they all seem to agree, you know, that China's rise is inevitable. China has, you know, the political system has that advantage, you know, to tackle the so-called big things, right? That both sides seem to agree. And although on the U.S. side, it seems to that this poses a big threat, you know, to the liberal democracy. I think if this book can tell us something, it's that, first of all, we take the Chinese rise as a given. We fail to recognize this mounting internal challenges China now is facing, including like environmental health challenges. And secondly, I believe we also overestimated that there's Chinese capability in the policy process. You know, that because if you look at the public policy process, including the political pollution control, right, the policy making remains, but right, there's no different from what was 30, 40 years ago. You know, still that, you know, that driven by political instinct, impromptu decision making, you know, no real evidence based or so-called scientific decision making, although that was promoted by Deng Xiaoping in the early 1980s. But you know, that pattern of impromptu non-participatory policy-making remains unchanged. And secondly, if you look at this policy implementation, it's still no different from the Mao era, right? This mobilizational approach, top-down approach, no public participation, right? And that they might be able to achieve short-term goals. They might even be able to incorporate high technologies to get the job done in a more efficient manner. But you know, that won't address the long-term goals. You know, that is, if we want the policy to be sustainable. And sometimes, you know, even those well-intentioned policies can lead to unintentional, undesirable consequences. We saw that in China's pollution control, for example, when in 2017, the Chinese, the leaders want to convert those coal-fired furnaces to clean energy, right? They want only convert 1.8 million furnaces, but the local government, you know, was so enthusiastic, you know, that about carrying that policy, like 2.3 million furnaces actually were converted. But the China didn't have that much gas to supply, so end up a lot of people, you know, end up starving in the shivering winter cold. You know, so that's just an example of how, you know, this model, the so-called China model, it won't provide a long-term solution to the country's mounting challenges.
Interesting. One counter-historical question. If the United States had performed much better on COVID, essentially we had performed as well as some of the Asian countries, would that have had political ramifications in China? Would people have basically held up China, compared it with the United States? And unlike now, where a lot of people in China are saying, we've done better, therefore it shows the superiority of our approach. If we had done a lot better ourselves, both absolutely and relatively, could that have had real political, essentially, did we lose an opportunity to potentially shake things up in China?
Oh, absolutely. I think one of the reasons why, you know, the government touted, you know, the so-called China model, or the superiority of the Chinese political system is, you know, first of all, because of the success to contain the spread in China. And secondly, because of failure of the U.S. to stem the spread of the virus. You know, so if the United States was able actually manage to contain the spread of the virus, even with the Chinese approach, although I think that is not feasible, it won't cost the U.S. so much soft power internationally, and especially for liberal-minded Chinese people, you know, Chinese intellectuals, really they're very disappointed by what the United States had experienced, you know, and you know, some of them turned more nationalistic, you know, and even more anti-American, you know, that I think really it's the failure of the U.S. On the foreign policy front as well.
Okay, I will resist the temptation to fill up the available time with questions, not because I don't have questions, but because I want to give others a chance. So, Carrie, let me hand the back to you, and you take it from here.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, to ask a question during the Q&A, please click on the raise hand icon on your Zoom window. When you are called on, accept the unmute now button and proceed with your name, affiliation, and question. To view the roster of CFR members registered to attend this meeting or to purchase a copy of the book, please click on the link in your Zoom chat box. We will take our first question from Joan Kaufman.
Thank you very much, Yanzheng, for a great book talk. And I wanted to ask, you focused a lot on air pollution, but I wanted to raise the issue also of water and soil pollution, which are really substantial in China. And ask you, you know, I think that this has the potential to lead to high rates of cancer and birth defects over the long term from the very, very substantial toxic runoff, plastics, leather mining industry, and all this in rural China over a very, very long period of time. And I wanted to ask you if you could just say a little bit about that and the potential long-term impacts that might come from from the early life exposures and long-term exposures in terms of the healthcare system. It seems like a sleeping time bomb and something that has really been underestimated in terms of China's healthcare costs and other potential impacts. So that's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan. Good to have you see you here. I think basically there are three major environmental health hazards, right? The air pollution, water pollution, and soil contamination. I'm glad that you brought to my attention the issue of water and soil pollution. We know that the water pollution remains a daunting challenge in China. In 2012, you know, they said more than 70% of Chinese people feel threatened by water pollution. And the soil pollution is another challenge, right? This before 2014 national survey revealed that the 7% of the soil in China is contaminated with cadmium, and 1/5 of China's farmland soil is severely polluted with toxic chemicals. And according to a more recent report by the Chinese scientists, they say that 36,000 hectares of farmland contains quote unquote excessive levels of heavy metals that led to the contamination of 12 million tons of grains each year. So this is a very huge problem China has to tackle. The water and soil contamination, then, as you correctly pointed out, contribute to this rise of as many as 351 so-called cancer villages. This is essentially the cancer clusters, you know, where the cancer rates unusually high. But there's another issue that is connected to the water and soil pollution is this food safety issue. Right? There's a Chinese saying, you know, for the emperor, the people are everything. And for the people, food is everything. And I remember when I grew up in the Chinese countryside, East China, my dream, biggest dream was to have a bowl of rice every day. you know, that that time, you know, was the, that the food safety was not a concern at all, you know, but today, you know, while hundreds of millions of people and being lifted out of poverty, you know, that many people could have access to a sufficient amount of food, right, that this food safety become a major concern. In fact, there's a study suggesting that more than 28% of the this rice samples in found according to the Ministry of Agriculture, more than 28% of the rice samples were laced with levels of lead, you know, that exceeded the national safety standards, and 10% of them had excess cadmium. So now that China has been expanded its efforts to pollution control, I think they're going to have to shift their more attention more to these two issues.
Great. Thank you, Joan. Carrie, let's get another question in.
Take our next question from Ken Morse.
Thank you very much for this very honest approach. You mentioned the strong requirement, this is Ken Morse in Boston. The strong requirement for local decision-making about power plants, and they don't take into account the externalities of pollution. But what about the impact on the rest of the world? Maple trees in Japan and the west coast of the US, pollution from China. And about 98% of the mercury in the air over Los Angeles is coming from China. And it seems very, you didn't mention corruption either. It's pretty easy to pay off a regulator.
Yeah, well, that, thank you, Kang. Exactly, corruption is another factor that contribute to this rampant pollution at the local level. There was, I remember one Chinese scholar say, you know, that this local government officials did not have strong incentives to tackle the pollution because the local polluters have no incentives to tackle the pollution. Because you know, the price they used to pay this local regulator is much smaller than the cost of fixing the pollution. But you're right. I think we, the United States, should also be concerned because by the impact of the pollution is not going to be confined within Chinese borders, right? This is for two reasons. First, through atmospheric transmission, by the pollution from air pollution from China, could contribute to environmental degradation in the United States. We already know that it contributes to 65% of the ozone increase in Western United States. And secondly, we know a lot of the pollution produced in China actually came from the export sector in China. Now we are considering, well, in a way, we are outsourcing not just the exports to China, we are also outsourcing the pollution to the country. Now we're considering relocating some of the industries back to the United States. There is a likelihood that some of this pollution will be also returned to the United States. And so you may have noticed the recent Pew survey in March found that the China's impact on the global environment tops America's list of concerns toward China.
Okay, Carrie, let's get another.
Take our next question from Tom Boyke.
Let me start by congratulating you, Yun Zhang, for a great achievement on this book. I'm really excited about it. I think it's an important piece of work. I wanted to ask a two-part question. The first is, I was struck by the conversation you had with Richard beforehand about the strengths of the Chinese political system in the end stage in mobilizing response to the pandemic, but its weakness in responding to matters like environmental safety and food safety. You write a lot about China, but you also study emerging economies generally. And I was wondering if you see a broader pattern there of political determinants and how they break out across different health challenges. Second, I was going to ask you just about where you see coming out of this pandemic, when we eventually do, hopefully sooner than later, where you see China's role in global health generally moving. Will they remain invested? Will that investment broaden as a result of this pandemic?
Well, thank you, Tom. This book also benefited a lot from your support. As the director of the Global Health Program, being your support has been very, very important to the successful completion of this book. So let me, since you have two questions, let me briefly just talk about China's COVID response and its response to its environmental health crises. Well, there's two different kinds of problem, right? Because environmental health issues is a slow disaster, right? COVID is more acute outbreak. And there, well, you actually could see this parallel, right, between the two. You know, first, you ignore the problem, you deny the problem. You know, then once the leaders, you know, found what this realized this is a big issue, you know, they're facing a crisis, they started to undertake decisive action. And they actually, decisive action turned out to be successful in certain areas. But I want to point out, even in China's COVID control efforts, with this record is not entirely as rosy as was portrayed by the Chinese government. You know, we know, right, again, like its approach to pollution control, this is essentially a campaign style approach. It has its own shortcomings, right? Human rights issues notwithstanding, draconian measures, right? They have dampened the economic growth. You know that even though China's economic growth is continued, it's still considered one of the highest. But the first three quarters of the Chinese GDP growth is only 0.7%. It also serves only short-term goals, you know, so, you know, that even though it tries to institutionalize those campaigns, right, we saw what was happening in Qingdao, in Kashgar, in Beijing, and Wuhan. They try to institutionalize those campaigns, you know, that fostering that model, right? Once you find even one case, you started to taking, you know, mass testing measures, you know, sealing off, you know, at least a partial of the cities, you know, they are doing all this quarantine and isolation things. This also has this perverse, encourage the perverse bureaucratic incentives in the policy implementation, you know, because the focus in terms of policymaking, is the top-down approach. When the top leaders say, we want zero infections, right, that, the local leaders, they, you know, have no choice but to rely on this cookie cutter approach, you know, that the draconian approach, you know, even though, you know, from the cost benefit perspective, that may not be necessary. Secondly, let me briefly talk about China's role in global health. I think you are an expert. You know that how China has been trying to, first of all, showcase, you know, the success of the Chinese approach to COVID. You know, then promote the so-called vaccine diplomacy. You know, prioritize the vaccine supply to certain countries, and initially opted out of the WHO COVAX pillar, like the United States has been doing, but now they have joined the COVAX mechanism, and looks like they're going to announce a successful development of vaccine next month, earliest, you know, but no later than the end of this year. So, you know, that I expect China to play a much bigger role in the global health now that the United States is still not interested in playing its own leadership role.
But will they allow the WHO to become stronger and more independent? Or is China's idea of playing a larger role in global health that China in some ways comes to dominate the World Health Organization?
Well, that is the problem, right? The reason that the Trump administration decided to terminate its relationship with WHO because, according to him, the WHO became China-dominated or China-centric. You know, my study of this issue found that increasing Chinese leverage over WHO, but it's probably overstatement to say that WHO is dominated by the by China. But of course, now that the U.S. is no longer a member of the WHO, you know, that essentially means, you know, that actually enabled China to play a much bigger role in terms of influencing the WHO agenda, including the WHO leadership.
Mm-hmm. So let me just ask one other question quickly here. Is there any sign that China's done any evidence whatsoever, a kind of after-action report where there's been any quiet self-criticism or any reform of decision-making in the health area as a result of what happened in the first 6 weeks?
Well, that is a good question, but it depends on where you ask that. If you ask that question like early February, and there seems to be a lot of lesson learned. You know, there was like, even those people who initially favor the government approach, you know, they were very frustrated. You know, they are talking about, you know, how, you know, this, you know, the political system has been a contributor, you know, to the problems. You know, I sense that kind of self-reflection happening not just in the elite Chinese decision maker, among the elite decision makers, but also among the public. But then, you know, that I think the death of Dr. Li Wenliang sort of is the watershed, you know, that when you suddenly have so many Chinese, because they said like that night he died, 800, there were like 800 million, right, Weibo chat, the messages, you know, that morning, Dr. Li, you know, so that I believe really raised like a red flag, you know, that so the government decided to impose more social control, you know, more crackdown on the social media. In the meantime, that also gave them the incentive to reshape the narrative, talk about the government's role in handling the crises. You know, so now, if you look at the government report on China's, or the white paper on China's role in the pandemic, that initial 6 weeks, you know, that how they mishandled the crisis is like completely eliminated from that narrative. You know, so they could, have all this research papers, you know, the discussions, consultant going on in terms of how to fix the so-called loopholes in the public health infrastructure. But in the meantime, I haven't heard any serious reflection of what went wrong in the political institutions that causes the problem.
Well, they'll never admit they went wrong, but it'll be interesting to see if they institute changes which reflect an internal recognition that they didn't get it right. We can watch and say, Carrie, we've got time for one more question, particularly if I quiet down. So let's get it.
Take our next question from Francis Beinecke.
Thank you very much for this presentation, and I look forward to reading the book. I wonder if you would comment on how much President Xi Jinping's commitment to the ecological civilization actually influences China's investments in the Belt and Road Initiative and its appetite for natural resources worldwide. My own sense is, you know, it's a great public commitment to make, but China has a voracious appetite for the resources of our oceans, our forests, that it's investing heavily in a port development, heavy industry, carbon intensive transportation systems, and that the ecological principle or the ecological civilization that he talks eloquently about actually isn't followed through on in the way China conducts itself globally in the environmental arena. Could you just comment on that, please?
Yeah, President Xi thank you, Francis. President Xi is an advocate of stronger pollution control. You know, we've seen, right, all these campaigns, those action plans, movements, you know, toward better environmental protection. And more recently, but you have heard, right, how they, he announced with the United Nations that China will achieve that goal of carbon being carbon neutral by 2060. And so I did, you know, I think find that he's committed to pollution control. He's committed to protecting the environment. He's committed to fulfilling the climate change goals. But in the meantime, the question is how sustainable his policy agenda is. You know, because this entire thing, unlike the United States, is not like a bottom-up approach. It's essentially top-down. It's mobilizational, you know, and it also hinged upon essentially how determined he was in sticking to that agenda, you know, because if the leadership attention goes away, you know, they, you know, that the signal he sent will no longer be coherent, then the local implementers will be have more leeway and more incentive, you know, to choose what they're going to do at the local level. I think in order for those agenda to be sustainable, the China still need to be like the United States, not just needs strengthen the pollution control, the institutions, they also need to enlarge, institutionalize the public participation in that process. They need to emphasize the rule of law. You know, that is critical, you know, because in the United States, even though you have like an administration who wants to change or relax these environmental these regulations, you know, simply because of an independent judiciary system, right? You could have the people, you know, to sue the government, to challenge the government decisions. In fact, we found that the 87% of those cases actually the Trump administration didn't win in the terms of environmental regulation.
Yang Zhang, we've got 2 minutes left, so I've got a quick lightning round for you. Two quick questions. Do you have any thoughts you want to share about the origin of COVID-19? We've seen all the speculation and the rest. Are you persuaded or do you still have doubts about the origins of in Wuhan?
Well, thank you, Richard. I think the issue of the origins of the outbreak have been too much politicized, you know, not just in China, but also in the United States. In the beginning, I mean, until like mid-February, I think it was a scientific issue. You know, in fact, they even, you know, in China, you know, nobody seems to deny that Wuhan was the COVID ground zero, right? And the United States, you know, didn't accuse China, you know, for being causing the outbreak. But then around mid-February, you suddenly have Dr. Zhou Nanshan, he's the sort of like a China's Dr. Anthony Fauci figure. He talked about that the virus may not necessarily originate in China. you know, that was immediately picked up by the Chinese, you know, foreign ministry spokesperson, you know, who started to sort of spread all these conspiracy theories, you know, that this virus might be even originating from the United States. So I still believe, you know, that this consensus of the scientific community, you know, that this is more like a naturally occurring outbreak. Although I won't rule out easily that possibility, that could be a lab escape.
Well, is there any last question? Is there any chance your book gets published in China as a, if you will, a helpful critic? Or is this seen as simply, if you will, toxic politics, and it could never be published in Mandarin?
Well, look at the title of the book. I think, well, maybe when it's translating to Chinese, they may no longer have that meaning that is so sounds so fancy. But I hope you know that. The Chinese leaders could read the book, you know, as someone like trying to provide the constructive criticisms mm-hmm. to improve their work, and not think that is trying to be like another example of China bashing.
Well, I would be 100% confident the leadership and experts will read it. I am skeptical it will be published and it's certainly with its current title or its current form. The good news, it's published here. And I really do urge people to read it. It is a synthesis again of worlds of environment and health and the economy and politics that normally are not dealt with comprehensively. I learned a lot. It's an important book. So congratulations again on having written it. Here it is. I really urge people to buy it. Then if you buy it, you have the added option of reading it. But as all authors would say, most important, go out there and stimulate the economy, support this author. And in this case, you will be you'll be well rewarded with a really thoughtful and extraordinarily well-researched and documented and well-written book. So again, congratulations and thank you for doing it. And thanks for being with us today.